Imagine a country's entire power grid, its very stability, relying completely on software.
Okay.
Now, imagine that software needing to adapt like lightning fast to power a massive green energy revolution.
Huge challenge.
How do you possibly balance absolute non-negotiable safety with that kind of incredible velocity?
Yeah, that's the crux of it.
That's the profound puzzle we're tackling today. We're taking a deep dive into Energinet, Denmark's transmission system operator, and the, well, the truly unique challenge they face,
Right.
modernizing their software development to be both incredibly resilient and incredibly agile. Our mission, as always, is to extract the actionable insights, the surprising facts from their blueprint report.
And it's quite a report. It synthesizes best practices from tech leaders, regulated industries, critical infrastructure peers.
Exactly. So let's unpack this. How do you ensure the lights stay on while simultaneously building the future?
What's really fascinating here, I think, is that it's not about choosing, speed or safety. It's about synthesizing them.
Synthesizing.
Yeah. Energinet's whole strategy is about integrating these two seemingly opposing forces through deliberate design.
That's the core tension, isn't it? The source material makes it abundantly clear this isn't some abstract idea for them.
No, it's very real.
On one hand, the green transition demands this unprecedented acceleration in digitalization. They need the agility, the velocity of it, like a top tech leader to manage a much more complex decentralized grid.
More renewables, more complexity.
Right. But then, as a transmission system operator, a TSO, they must uphold the absolute highest standards of reliability and security because the consequences of failure are just.
Profound, catastrophic, potentially.
So if that's the central challenge, what's their blueprint? How are they actually bridging that gap?
Okay, so they're focusing on three core pillars, things that high-performing organizations have really converged on.
Right.
The first is platform engineering, using that as the foundation.
Platform engineering.
This means having a central platform engineering team building an internal developer platform, an IDP.
An IDP.
And crucially, they treat this IDP as an internal product, their own developers. They're the customers.
Ah, okay. Interesting framing.
Yeah. And this platform provides what they call standardized, secure, and efficient golden paths to production.
Golden paths. So it's not just a random collection of tools, it's more like a paved road
Yeah.
designed to guide developers.
Exactly. Guiding them to do things the right way with security, compliance, all that stuff built in automatically.
That sounds like it could dramatically cut down on errors and will speed things up.
That's the idea. By making the right way the easy way through automation, you slash the cognitive load, reduce errors, and free up teams to focus on, actual business value.
Okay, pillar one, platform engineering and golden paths. What's number two?
Pillar two is organizational design for flow.
Flow.
This involves moving away from some of the more rigid frameworks like SAFe, the Scaled Agile Framework.
You heard of it. Can be quite heavy.
It can be. And moving towards more fluid, flow-based models. Specifically, they're looking at team topologies.
Team topologies. Okay, tell me more.
The core goal here is to minimize dependencies and handoffs between teams. Those are notorious, right, for slowing down big organizations.
Absolutely. Communication overhead, waiting times.
Exactly. So team topologies aims to unlock higher velocity and much more team autonomy by structuring teams specifically to reduce those friction points.
Okay, makes sense. Platform, team structure. What's the third pillar? The one that enables this controlled agility.
That would be automated risk-based governance.
Right, because traditional governance feels like the brakes.
Totally. Those old-school change advisory boards, CAB meetings, they just don't scale for modern software delivery. Forget about deploying multiple times a day.
So what's the alternative?
Embedding governance directly into the workflows using policy as code.
Yeah.
Policy as code.
Yeah, it allows for automated, continuous enforcement of security, compliance, operational standards, all within the development pipeline itself.
So the checks happen automatically as code moves along. Precisely. It makes the right way the easy way, without needing a human gatekeeper for every single step. Some advanced places even use AI to assess the risk of each change and apply scrutiny proportionally. Less risky changes fly through, riskier ones get more attention.
That's a huge shift from the usual governance bottleneck. So, how does this actually impact the pace? And crucially, how do they know if it's working? What are they measuring?
Good question. They use two key frameworks. First, the DORA metrics. These are pretty much the industry standard now for measuring software delivery performance.
DORA. Okay. What does that include?
It includes Deployment frequency, basically, how often you push code to production. Elite performers, multiple times a day.
Wow. Okay.
Then there's lead time for changes. That's the time from a developer committing code to that code actually running in production. For elite teams, it's less than one day.
Less than a day. That's fast, especially for critical infrastructure.
It is. Those are the velocity metrics. But DORA also covers stability, which is obviously key for a TSO.
Right. What are those?
There's change failure rate, the percentage of deployments that cause a problem, like an outage or requiring a hotfix. Elite teams keep this super low, like 0 to 15%.
0 to 15%. Okay.
And finally, mean time to recover, MTPR. If something does break, how fast can you fix it and restore service? Elite performers, less than an hour.
Less than an hour recovery. Impressive.
And these DORA metrics are powerful because they measure outcomes, right? The real world impact, not just, you know, how busy people seem.
Outcomes, not just outputs. Got it. And you said there was a second framework to balance the tech performance?
Yes, that's the SPACE framework.
SPACEy.
Yeah. While DORA measures the performance of the delivery system, SPACE gives a much more multidimensional view of developer productivity and experience. It's designed to counter those simplistic, often harmful metrics, like just counting lines of code.
Ah, okay. So it's about the people, the developers themselves, not just the code.
Precisely. It's about understanding their experience. SPACE covers five dimensions.
Nope.
S is for satisfaction and well-being. Are developers happy, feeling burnt out? P is for performance, the actual outcomes, quality, impact. A is activity stuff like commit volume, but viewed in context.
Okay.
C is communication and collaboration. How well do teams and individuals work together? And E is efficiency and flow. Can developers actually get work done without tons of interruptions and delays?
Well, it's a much more humane way to look at productivity.
Exactly. More humane, more accurate.
Yeah.
It recognizes that developer happiness, their ability to achieve flow, it directly correlates with innovation, quality, everything.
So for you, the listener, and for Energinet, the big goal is driving that elite DORA performance, fast and stable delivery, while fostering world-class developer experience, or DevEx, measured by SPACE. And all that without compromising grid stability. It's a really complex puzzle, and these frameworks are how they're sort of deconstructing it.
Okay, we've got the blueprint. Platform engineering, team topologies, automated governance, measured by DORA and SPACE. But how do you actually build that engine? Let's dig into the organizational design piece more. You mentioned moving away from SAFe. What's the issue with SAFe in this context?
Well, SAFe, the scaled agile framework, it's very structured, very prescriptive. And look, it appeals to large organizations, especially regulated ones, because it promises control and predictability.
Seems reasonable on the surface.
Yeah, but the criticism is that it often comes with what's called high ceremony. Think about those huge program increment planning events, all the mandatory meetings.
Right, the overhead. Exactly. Significant overhead and bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And the sources we looked at point out that if you implement SAFe without a really strong focus on technical excellence and genuine team autonomy, it can easily just evolve into a ticket factory.
A ticket factory, meaning?
If teams just focus on closing tickets, following the process, but they lose sight of actually delivering value. There's also this anti-pattern called cargo cult adoption, just copying the structure without understanding why it works or if it's right for you.
So SAFe can actually end up slowing things down if you're not careful. What about the Spotify model? That was trendy for a while. Squads, tribes.
It was. And it got a lot of buzz for its focus on autonomous squads, tribes, chapters, guilds. Yeah. It seemed very empowering, very people-driven.
There's always a but.
The crucial nuance is Spotify never meant it to be a formal framework to copy. Its success was highly dependent on Spotify's own very mature engineering culture, their strong technical foundations.
Mm.
So organizations that tried to just lift and shift the structure without having that underlying culture and tech maturity, they often failed. The model itself provides very little formal governance, which can lead to chaos if you have lots of dependencies or a less mature culture. Copying structure without culture rarely works.
Okay, so SAFe, potentially too rigid, too much overhead, Spotify model. Maybe too loose, too reliant on existing culture. What's the modern solution Energinet is leaning towards? You mentioned team topologies.
Yes, team topologies. It's generally seen as the most modern and deliberate approach to designing software delivery organizations today. Its explicit focus is on minimizing the cognitive load on teams.
Cognitive load, meaning how much stuff a team has to keep in their heads to do their job.
Exactly, and optimizing for a fast flow of change.
How does it actually do that? What are the building blocks?
It defines four fundamental team types. First, you have your stream-aligned teams. These are your core product teams, cross-functional, focused on delivering direct business or customer value. end-to-end responsibility for a service or product.
Okay, streamlined. Makes sense.
Then supporting them, you have platform teams. These build and run the internal platform like that IDP we talked about, providing tools and services to help the streamlined teams go faster. They treat the platform as a product.
Got it. What else?
You also have enabling teams. These are specialists, maybe experts in, say, CI/CD or test automation, who help other teams adopt new capabilities or overcome specific hurdles. Usually they embed for a short time and then move on.
Like internal consultants, almost?
Kind of, yeah. Focused on capability uplift.
Mm.
And finally, there are complicated subsystem teams. These manage parts of the system that require really deep, specialized knowledge. Think maybe a complex legacy component or a specialized algorithm. They shield other teams from that complexity.
So team topology seems really focused on managing complexity and dependencies, which, as you said, are huge drags in big organizations.
Absolutely. It's all about reducing those handoffs and ensuring teams aren't overwhelmed. They also define three clear interaction modes between these teams: collaboration, X as a service, and facilitation. It's designed for sustainable flow, not just a temporary speed boost.
And the platform engineering team is central to making this work, providing those X as a service capabilities,
yeah,
including the golden paths.
Yes, absolutely central. That idea of treating the platform as an internal product with developers as customers, that's key. The platform team's mission is to reduce developer cognitive load by abstracting away all the underlying complexity infrastructure, security, compliance, monitoring.
Shifting that responsibility down onto the platform.
Exactly. So application developers can focus purely on the business logic, the features that deliver value, not wrestling with Kubernetes manifests or security policies every day.
Let's talk more about these golden paths. It sounds like more than just documentation.
Oh, much more. A golden path is an opinionated, standardized, and supported workflow for doing a common task, like creating a new microservice, setting up a database, deploying an application.
Opinionated means the platform team has made choices.
Yes. They've figured out the best, most secure, most compliant way to do it at EnergyNet, and they've baked that into the path. These are tangible things. Templates, code generators, pre-configured pipeline definitions, often accessed through a central developer portal.
So if I'm a developer and I use the golden path to create a new service.
Boom. You instantly get a service skeleton with CI/CD, pre-configured, security scanning baked in, monitoring and logging setup, compliance checks already running. All the guardrails are there from the start.
That sounds like it makes the secure, compliant way the easiest way.
That's precisely the goal. The path of least resistance is the path that meets all the standards. It's huge for both velocity and safety.
Okay, so you've got the right org structure, a platform providing golden paths. How do you sustain that speed safely in the day-to-day development work? What are the key delivery practices?
A really foundational one is trunk-based development, or TBD.
Trunk-based development.
This means all developers commit their code changes directly to the main shared branch, the trunk, ideally at least once a day. Small, frequent commits.
Instead of working on separate feature branches for weeks.
Exactly. Those long-lived feature branches are notorious for causing painful merge hell when you finally try to integrate them. TBD forces continuous integration. Issues get found and fixed fast when they're small. It helps ensure the code base is basically always in a releasable state.
Always releasable, okay. And when you do want to release, how do you roll it out without breaking things, especially in EnergyNet's world?
Through progressive delivery techniques. It's a set of strategies to reduce the risk of releases by gradually exposing the new version.
Like dipping your toe in the water.
Kinda, yeah. One key technique is feature flags, or feature toggles. These let you deploy code to production, but keep the new feature hidden until you're ready. You can then turn it on for internal testers, then maybe 1% of users, then 10%, and so on. It decouples deployment from release.
Gives you control. Lets you do A/B tests, too.
Exactly. Though you have to be careful about managing those flags accumulating too many creates flag debt, which can become complex and risky itself.
Right. What else for progressive delivery?
Then you have infrastructure-level patterns, like blue-green deployments and canary releases.
Blue-green and canary. Briefly, what are they?
Blue-green means you have two identical production environments, blue and green. You deploy the new version to the inactive one, test it, then just switch the router to send all traffic to the new environment. Rollback is instant, just switch back.
Okay. And canary.
Canary is more gradual. You deploy the new version to a small part of your production infrastructure, the canary instance. You then route a small percentage of live traffic, say 1% or 5%, to it. You watch it closely, check metrics, error rates. If all looks good, you gradually increase the traffic and roll it out to more instances.
Allows you to spot problems with only a small blast radius.
Precisely. But you need good monitoring and automated rollback capabilities.
Now, software isn't built in isolation. It uses libraries, components. There's a whole supply chain. How do you secure that?
That's a huge focus now. Software supply chain security.
Yeah.
And the key framework here is SLSA supply chain levels for software artifacts, pronounced SALSA.
SLSA. Okay. What does it involve?
It's a set of increasing levels, providing more guarantees about the integrity of your software artifacts, how they were built, and where they came from. SLSA level 1 requires a scripted build process and basic provenance metadata saying how it was built.
Okay, level 1 is basic automation.
Level 2 adds authenticated provenance, meaning the build service cryptographically signs that metadata, proving it hasn't been tampered with. Level 3 requires a fully hardened, isolated build platform designed to resist tampering during the build itself.
So higher levels mean more trust that the software hasn't been maliciously altered.
Exactly. And for regulated sectors, critical infrastructure like EnergyNet achieving at least SLSA level 2, probably aiming for level 3 for the most critical stuff, is becoming the baseline expectation.
Yeah. But hang on. Even with SLSA and Canaries deploying a new version, even to 1% of the live power grid, that sounds terrifying. How does EnergyNet adapt progressive delivery for their most critical systems?
You're absolutely right. The standard tech industry mantra of fail fast in production is completely, utterly unacceptable for a TSO managing a nation's power grid.
So no canaries on the live grid.
Definitely not for grid-impacting systems. Their adaptation is ingenious, though. They leverage high-fidelity, production-like environments for all that validation. And this is where the concept of a digital twin becomes absolutely critical.
A digital twin of the power grid.
Yes. Instead of doing a canary release to live users, they deploy the new software version first to this highly accurate digital twin.
And test it there.
Rigorously.
Yeah.
They can feed it real or simulated operational data. They can even run shadow traffic mirroring live production requests to the digital twin to see how the new version behaves under realistic load and conditions, all without any risk to the physical grid.
So they still get the benefits of progressive validation, but in a safe sandbox.
Exactly. It maintains the principles of gradual rollout and validation, but shifts it entirely into safe, pre-production stages for those ultra-critical systems.
Wow. Okay, so this blend, the team topologies, org design, the platform engineering with golden paths, the core practices like TBD, and then these adapted delivery methods using digital twins. That's how a critical infrastructure operator can actually achieve agility without compromising their core mission of reliability.
That's the synthesis they're aiming for. It's complex, but it's deliberate.
Now let's swing back to governance. You mentioned policy as code replacing traditional CAs. How does this idea of governance that enables, not stifles, really work in practice, making it an accelerator, not a handbrake?
It works through what they call controlled agility, moving fast, but with guardrails built in. And policy as code, PA, is the core mechanism.
Remind us again, defining policies in code.
Yeah, defining your security rules, compliance requirements, operational standards in a language that machines can understand and, crucially, automatically enforce.
Give me another concrete example. How might that look in a CI/CD pipeline?
Okay, imagine you're deploying infrastructure using code, like Terraform or Bicep. A park check in the pipeline could automatically verify. Does this configuration try to open a port that's forbidden? Does it use an approved VM size? Does it have mandatory logging enabled? Does it encrypt data at rest?
So it catches violations before they even get deployed.
Exactly. It shifts enforcement left, making it proactive and preventative, rather than a reactive audit finding problems weeks or months later. It prevents the bad configuration from ever hitting production.
Which means those change advisory board meetings, the traditional bottleneck, they largely go away for routine changes.
For many changes, yes. The modern approach is automated, risk-based approvals. If a change is simple, comes from a trusted source, passes all the automated PACI checks and tests, maybe it just deploys automatically.
And for riskier changes?
Maybe it triggers an automated notification for a specific person or team to review. Or, like we mentioned with Meta's diff risk score, an AI model assesses the potential risk based on the code change, its history, its dependencies.
Right, the DRS.
Yeah. And that score dynamically adjusts the level of scrutiny. Low risk, maybe just an automated check. High risk, it might require multiple human reviews, more extensive testing in the digital twin. It focuses human attention where it's most needed.
That's incredibly smart. Using AI to streamline compliance. What about audits? Audits are usually painful, manual exercises.
PA kills massively here too. Because governance is embedded in the pipeline, compliance evidence gets generated automatically. Every time a check passes a security scan, a policy validation, a test suite, it can generate a signed attestation.
Like a digital receipt saying, this passed.
Exactly. And these receipts, along with things like software bills of materials, SMUMs, get collected into a central, immutable audit log. When the auditors arise, instead of scrambling for documents for weeks,
you just give them read access to the log.
Pretty much. Here's the verifiable proof that all policies were enforced for every change. We heard Goldman Sachs has invested heavily in automating their SDLC this way to meet their super strict financial regulations. It turns audit from a nightmare into, well, just another process.
And the platform team is likely providing these reusable policies and pipeline templates, making it easy for developers.
Yes, that's a core function of the platform. They build and maintain a library of policy as code policies that map directly to regulations like NIS2 or industry standards like ISO 27019 for energy cloud security or IEC 62443 for industrial controls.
So developers consume governance as a service.
Exactly. The platform's golden paths come pre-configured with these governance gates. Developers can move fast, confident that the platform is keeping them compliant by default.
Okay, this prevents issues, streamlines compliance. But for EnergyNet, zero downtime isn't just a target. It's like a fundamental requirement. How do they engineer for that level of reliability day in, day out?
That's where site reliability engineering, or SRE, comes in full force.
SRE originated at Google, right?
That's right. It's all about applying software engineering principles, automation, measurement, systematic thinking, two operations problems. It's built on a few core concepts.
Like what?
First, SLIs, service level indicators. These are specific quantitative measures of your service's performance. Things like request latency, error rate, system throughput, availability.
Measurable things.
Then SLOs, service level objectives. These are the target values you set for your SLIs. For example, maybe 99.99% availability or 95% of requests served in under 200 milliseconds. This defines how reliable the service needs to be from the user's perspective.
Okay, SLI is the measure, SLO is the target. What else?
The crucial concept is the error budget. This is derived directly from your SLO. If your SLO is 99.99% availability, that means you have a 0.01% budget for unavailability. That's your error budget.
The acceptable amount of unreliability.
Exactly. And here's the key SRE principle. If you consume your error budget for a period, meaning you have too many outages or too much downtime, all new feature development for that service stops.
Stops completely.
Yes. The team's entire focus shifts to reliability work, fixing bugs, improving monitoring, adding resilience until the service is back within its SLO and the budget starts replenishing. It creates a powerful feedback loop that balances velocity with stability.
So for EnergyNet's really critical lane one systems, the SLOs must be incredibly high, like 99.999% or even more nines.
Absolutely. Five nines, six nines.
What does that mean for their error budget then and their ability to push changes?
It means a near zero error budget. Mm. Effectively, there's no budget for unplanned, failure-inducing changes in production.
Wow.
Which reinforces why everything has to be meticulously planned, validated in the digital twin, and rolled out with extreme caution. There's simply no room for error. Engineering for prevention becomes absolutely paramount.
And to really build confidence in that prevention, they need to know how the system behaves when things do go wrong, not just when it's sunny. That sounds like chaos engineering.
It does. Chaos engineering is the practice of deliberately injecting failures into a system in a controlled way, maybe terminating random servers, injecting network latency, simulating a database failure to proactively find weaknesses before they cause a real outage.
Sounds scary, but valuable. But surely they don't do that on the live power grid.
No, absolutely not. Just like with progressive delivery, running chaos experiments directly against the live safety-critical production environment is completely unacceptable for EnergyNet.
So, the digital twin again?
The digital twin is the hero again. All chaos experiments for their critical lane one systems are conducted only within that high fidelity digital twin environment.
So they can simulate losing a whole data center or a major network link breaking?
Exactly. They can rigorously test the system's resilience and recovery mechanisms in response to all sorts of potential real world failures, but without any actual risk to the physical grid. Allows them to build confidence in their resilience engineering.
Makes total sense. And when incidents inevitably do happen, despite all the prevention, what's the SRE approach to learning from them?
That's the blameless post-incident review, or post-mortem.
Blameless, key word.
Absolutely critical. The goal is not to find someone to blame. It's to deeply understand the systemic factors, the technical issues, the process gaps, the contributing circumstances that led to the failure.
Focus on the what and how, not the who.
Precisely. The entire focus is on learning. What can we change in our systems, our tools, our processes, our monitoring to prevent this specific class of incident from ever happening again? This culture of psychological safety, where people feel safe to talk about mistakes, is a hallmark of highly reliable organizations.
So tying this segment together, what does this all mean for an organization trying to be both fast and safe? It means governance isn't a blocker, it's automated and enabling. And reliability isn't just hoped for, it's actively engineered using SRE principles, validated with things like chaos testing and digital twins, and constantly improved through blameless learning.
That's the essence of it. It's turning governance into an accelerator and reliability into a core engineering discipline.
Okay, let's pivot to a topic that's everywhere right now. AI. The report talks about an AI-first software development lifecycle. Where does AI fit into this picture? What are the really high-value use cases they're seeing?
AI is definitely starting to permeate almost every phase of software development. Some clear high-value use cases are emerging. Code generation and completion is a big one. Think tools like GitHub Copilot.
Helping write boilerplate code, suggesting completions.
Exactly. It can significantly speed up writing routine code. We saw Shopify accept something like 20,000 lines of AI-suggested code every day. That's substantial.
Wow. Okay, code generation. What else?
Test case generation is another promising area. AI can analyze code and help generate relevant test cases, potentially improving coverage and quality. Shopify apparently built an internal tool called Roast that uses AI to grade existing tests and suggest new ones.
Interesting. Using AI to improve testing. Makes sense.
Then there's AI for code review assistance. An AI can act like an automated reviewer, scanning code changes for potential bugs, security flaws, style issues, things a human reviewer might miss or take longer to spot.
Like a super linter?
Kind of, but potentially more sophisticated. Microsoft reported their internal AI tool significantly sped up pull request completion times. AI is also proving useful for documentation, automatically generating summaries of code, explaining complex functions, and for powering better knowledge management and search within code bases.
And you mentioned AI for risk.
That initial study did get a lot of attention, yeah. A 55.8% speed up is huge. But the source material we looked at, and more recent independent research, paints a much more nuanced picture. There are some critical caveats.
Ah, okay, what's the catch? This raises an important question. Why the contradiction? What does this mean for how we really apply AI effectively?
Well, a really rigorous independent study came out mid-2025 from METR. They looked at experienced open source developers working on complex, real-world programming tasks, and they found something surprising.
Which was?
The developers using the latest, most powerful frontier AI tools actually took 19% longer on average to complete their tasks compared to those without AI assistance.
Longer, not faster. That completely contradicts the earlier finding.
It does. And what's even more fascinating, these same developers perceived that they were about 20% faster when using the AI tools.
Wait, so they felt faster but were actually slower.
Exactly. A significant gap between their subjective experience and the objective reality of their performance on these complex tasks.
That's wild. What explains that? Why would AI slow down experienced devs on complex problems?
The thinking is, it points to the type of task. AI seems to excel at relatively well-defined, self-contained, often greenfield tasks, generating new boilerplate, writing simple functions, maybe summarizing code, tasks where the context is limited.
Okay.
But its effectiveness seems to diminish and can even become negative when you apply it to complex modifications within large existing high-stakes systems, what we call brownfield development.
Modifying existing complex code.
Right. In those scenarios, deep context, understanding subtle interactions, non-obvious implications, that's all paramount. AI-generated code, even if it looks plausible, might contain subtle bugs, security flaws, or just non-idiomatic patterns that don't fit well. It often requires significant human effort to review, debug, refine, and properly integrate it into the larger system.
So the time saved generating the initial code might be lost or even exceeded by the time spent fixing and integrating it.
That seems to be the case for complex brownfield work, according to this research. The AI can sometimes add more complexity than it solves in those situations.
Okay, so AI is clearly not a silver bullet, especially for the kind of critical systems EnergyNet manages. How are they approaching AI adoption, knowing this nuance, given their dual mandate of speed and safety?
Their strategy is very much risk stratified, based on that two-lane model we talked about.
Right, lane one, critical, and lane two, less critical.
Exactly. For lane two systems, things like internal tools, analytics platforms, exploratory projects, they encourage reflexive use of AI. Let teams experiment, use the tools freely, see where they can accelerate prototyping and development.
Okay, more freedom in lane two. What about lane one, the safety critical grid systems?
For lane one, the rule is crystal clear. AI is strictly a co-pilot, never an autopilot.
Co-pilot, not autopilot, meaning?
Meaning any AI-generated code, configuration, test case, documentation, anything produced by AI that impacts a lane one system requires rigorous human review and validation by a qualified engineer. The human remains fully accountable for the final output. No exceptions.
So the human expert is always in the loop and holds the ultimate responsibility.
Always. They also stress the need to objectively measure AI's actual impact using real metrics, lead time, change failure rate, defect density, not just relying on developers saying they feel more productive. They want to see the proof in the door in space metrics.
That makes sense. And to manage all this responsibly, especially with sensitive data potentially involved, they must have a solid governance framework specifically for AI, right?
Absolutely essential. A formal AI governance framework is a prerequisite. It's built on core principles: accountability, transparency, fairness, security, and resilience.
Standard principles for responsible tech. How do they operationalize them?
A key operational control, especially for lane one, is that human in the loop, HITL, must be the default mode. A qualified human must review, validate, and ultimately take responsibility for any AI-generated output before it gets anywhere near production. This aligns perfectly with regulations like the EU AI Act, which mandates appropriate human oversight for high-risk AI systems.
Okay, human oversight is non-negotiable for critical stuff. What about data privacy? You can't just feed proprietary source code or grid data into public AI models, can you?
Definitely not. That's another critical part of the governance. Strict policies on data input. There's an absolute prohibition on submitting proprietary source code, any personally identifiable information, PII, or sensitive operational data into public AI tools like ChatGPT or even public Copilot.
So what do they use?
They strongly prefer enterprise-grade AI tools, perhaps hosted internally or through vendors, that provide contractual guarantees that customer data won't be used for training the public models and is properly secured. Controlling inputs and outputs is paramount.
And they likely have rules about which specific AI tools developers can use.
Yes, they have risk-based guardrails, inspired by the EU AI Act's risk tiers. They classify AI tools. Approved Tier 1 tools are vetted and okay for general use within data policies. Limited approval Tier 2 might be okay for brainstorming, but not for generating production code. And prohibited Tier 3 are tools that haven't been vetted or are deemed too risky.
So the takeaway on AI is powerful potential, especially as a co-pilot. But for critical systems, it demands expert human oversight, rigorous validation, objective measurement, and a very strong governance framework to harness that power safely.
Exactly. It's not magic. It's a tool that needs to be wielded carefully and responsibly.
Okay, we've covered technology, process, governance, AI. Let's wrap up by talking about culture and the road ahead, because ultimately none of this works without the right culture and focus on people, does it?
Not at all. Technology and process are necessary, but they're not sufficient. The most profound transformations are always rooted in the organization's culture, and increasingly its commitment to the experience of its engineers, the developer experience, or DevEx.
So what does cultivating that high-performance engineering culture really mean in practice?
A big part of it is actively reducing unnecessary ceremony and focusing relentlessly on outcomes over just following process. We talked about how some frameworks, if implemented poorly, can lead to prioritizing process adherence, ticking the boxes, over actually delivering value.
The ticket factory again.
Right. The cultural shift is towards constantly questioning ceremony. Does this meeting actually add value? Does this process step help us deliver better outcomes faster and safer? Or is it just habit? The focus must be on tangible customer or business value.
And you mentioned developer experience, DevEx. Define that for us again, and why is it so critical for what EnergyNet is trying to achieve?
DevEx is basically the sum total of all the interactions a developer has with the tools, the platforms, the processes, the environment they need to do their job effectively.
So everything from their laptop setup to the CI/CD pipeline speed to how easy it is to find documentation.
Exactly. A positive DevEx means things like fast feedback loops from tests and deployments, a manageable cognitive load so they're not overwhelmed, clear paths to get things done, and the ability to achieve that state of flow where they can just focus and be productive.
And why is that so important?
Because leading organizations now recognize that great DevEx isn't just a nice to have for developers.
Yeah.
It directly impacts productivity, the quality of work, the pace of innovation, and maybe most importantly today, talent attraction and retention. Good developers want to work where they can be effective and not constantly fight the tools.
So Energinet's platform engineering team, they're responsible for DevEx.
Yes. The report explicitly states their platform engineering team will own the DevEx program at Energinet, and its success will be measured using that space framework we discussed earlier, tracking developer satisfaction, flow, collaboration, etc.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, if you're trying to build a more resilient, faster engine in your own work? What are the common traps, the anti-patterns to watch out for, even if you think you're adopting these best practices?
Oh, there are definitely common pitfalls. We already mentioned cargo cult adoption, copying Spotify or Google without understanding the principles. That rarely ends well.
Right. What else?
The platform team itself can become a bottleneck. If instead of providing self-service capabilities and golden paths, they make developers file tickets for every little thing, they just become a new source of delay.
So the platform needs to enable, not control.
Exactly. Another is having an underfunded or unempowered platform team. If it's just treated as a side project without real backing, developers will likely ignore it and build their own shadow IT, which leads back to inconsistency and risk.
The ticket factory mindset we keep mentioning.
That's a big cultural one. Teams just churning through tasks without connecting to the actual business impact. Then there are overloaded governance gates, making the review process so painful for small changes that developers batch things up into huge, risky releases just to avoid the hassle. Completely counterproductive.
Flaky tests.
Huge one. If your automated tests are unreliable and frequently fail for no reason, developers lose trust in the automation and start ignoring failures or working around them. That undermines the whole pipeline.
Any cultural anti-patterns?
Definitely. The heroics culture, celebrating the engineers who stay up all night firefighting instead of celebrating the teams that prevent fires in the first place through good engineering. Also, ignoring developer feedback, the platform team building what they think developers need instead of treating them like customers and actually listening to their pain points. And finally, a pervasive fear of failure, which prevents honest, blameless post-incident reviews and stifles learning and experimentation.
Lots to watch out for. It really is a dynamic balancing act. So how does Energinet bring all these pieces, the lanes, the practices, the culture together into their future operating model? Remind us of that two-lane system.
Right. The two-lane operating model is key to managing the different risk profiles across their software portfolio. Lane one is for those safety-critical, grid-impacting systems.
The never-fail-in-production lane.
Exactly. That means super strict automated governance using policy as code, aligned to all the relevant regulations like NIS2, ISO 27019, IEC 62443. They'll mandate SLSA level 3 for supply chain integrity. They'll use trunk-based development. Progressive delivery happens only to the digital twin, never live production. SRD principles mean near zero error budgets, and AI is strictly a co-pilot with 100% human review, maximum caution.
Okay, that's lane one and lane two.
Lane two is for exploration and enterprise systems. Internal tools, analytics, things that don't directly control the grid. The principle here is learn and iterate quickly.
More flexibility.
Much more. Governance is lighter touch. Maybe SLSA level one or two is sufficient. Continuous delivery directly to production is encouraged, using techniques like canary releases and feature flags. SRE principles still apply, but with more flexible error budgets that allow for some experimentation and failures. And AI usage can be broad and reflexive, letting teams innovate faster.
So clear separation based on criticality. But systems can change criticality over time, right? What if a lane two analytics tool becomes crucial for grid operations?
Good point. They need a way to move between lanes. That's the graduation path. It's a formal, defined process for a service to migrate from lane two to lane one as its criticality increases.
And that path itself is likely automated.
Exactly. The graduation process will itself be a golden path provided by the internal developer platform. It will guide the team through all the steps needed, enhancing testing, improving documentation, hardening security, ensuring operational readiness to meet the stringent requirements of lane one.
Very thorough. And this whole thing is obviously a journey, not an overnight switch.
Oh, absolutely. The report outlines a multi-year transformation roadmap with phased initiatives. Establish the platform team first, launch an MVP, the IDP, deploy the digital twin, gradually onboard services, etc. And they're realistic about the risks, things like cultural resistance, technical complexity, potential skills gaps, the platform becoming a bottleneck if not done right, or even perfectionism delaying value delivery. They have mitigation plans for these.
So, to recap this deep dive, we've explored how a critical piece of national infrastructure like EnergyNet is tackling the immense challenge of achieving both high-speed software delivery and rock-solid resilience. It's not magic, it's a deliberate strategic blend of modern organizational design like team topologies, advanced engineering practices enabled by platform engineering and golden paths, deeply integrated automated governance via policy as code, and a very careful risk-stratified adoption of AI.
It really underscores a key trend. The most successful innovative organizations today aren't just fast, they're fast because they've engineered reliability, security, and compliance right into their systems from the ground up. They treat resilience as an outcome you design for, not something you just hope for.
Absolutely. So let's leave our listeners with a final thought. Considering this interplay between technology, process, and human systems, take a look at a process in your own work. Where might you have a traditional bottleneck, maybe a manual review or a complex handoff? Could you, inspired by this, think about how to turn that into an automated golden path? And what insights might you gain if you shifted focus from just completing tasks, the ticket factory mindset, to measuring and improving the actual outcomes that matter? Food for thought.